From NPR and WBUR, I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. It's Here and Now. Today, Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell said that he supports a congressional investigation into possible Russian interference with last month's presidential election. McConnell said the reported cyber attacks were disturbing, even as Donald Trump continues to downplay them. Here's Trump on Fox News on Sunday, Chris Wallace asking the president-elect about claims by the CIA that Russians hacked the election, including the Democratic National Committee, to boost Donald Trump's chances of winning.
I think it's ridiculous. I think it's just another excuse. I don't believe it. I don't know why. And I think it's just, they talked about all sorts of things. Every week it's another excuse. We had a massive landslide victory, as you know, in the Electoral College. I guess the final numbers are now at 306, and she's, down to a very low number. No, I don't believe that at all.
Of course, Donald Trump lost the popular vote, and while he did comfortably win the Electoral College, he was at 46 out of 58 elections in the margins. And while the CIA said the Russians wanted to boost Trump's chances, they didn't say whether he had. Let's bring in NPR senior Washington editor and correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, back in October, the FBI said the Russians had hacked the election. The CIA has now gone further, saying they were backing Trump. How extraordinary is this, both that this report has come out and that an incoming president is dismissing his own CIA?
Extraordinary on all counts, Robin. I mean, as you just said, he describes his victory as a massive landslide victory. And as you point out, 45 of the Electoral College elections have been larger out of the 58 we've had since George Washington. So massive landslide, those are his words. Those are not the facts. Mm-hmm. And then we get to the FBI and the CIA agreeing that the Russians had hacked in, but having only this disagreement as to whether the Russians had hacked in or as to whether the Russians had hacked in to benefit Donald Trump. The FBI didn't want to go that far, but the CIA has gone that far, representing the consensus among 19 different intelligence agencies that work for the United States.
Yeah. Well, Mitch McConnell ended his press conference today with a show of support for that intelligence community. Let's listen.
Let me say that I have the highest confidence in the intelligence community and especially the central intelligence agencies. The CIA is filled with selfless patriots, many of whom anonymously risk their lives for the American people.
McConnell also went on to say, let me make it clear, the Russians are not our friends. What does this mean, Ron, as sort of an intra-Republican Party conversation?
Speaker Paul Ryan has just released a statement, and he points out that he has said before, quote, any foreign intervention in our elections is entirely unacceptable, and any intervention by Russia is especially problematic because under President Putin, Russia has been an aggressor that constantly and consistently undermines American interests. But then, of course, Paul Ryan goes on to say we shouldn't politicize this intelligence report and we should not cast doubt on the clear and decisive outcome of this election. Those are all quotes from Speaker Paul Ryan.
Well, then here's Senator John McCain today speaking with NPR. He's, of course, McCain, the chair of the Armed Services Committee. And here's what he told Steve Inskeep.
I don't think there's any doubt about that it was Russian, and it could have been others as well.
And we're hearing other reports, Ron, that it was the Russians interfering also in Brexit and in the election in Ukraine. Now, McCain and Senator Lindsey Graham are joining Democrats calling for an investigation. President Obama is saying he wants an investigation. So how's this ping-ponging around in Congress?
Congress is clearly interested in getting more information about what the Russians are up to here. Clearly, we do still have that question. Did they hack in for all kinds of reasons or any reasons? Or did they hack in specifically because they wanted to tip the scales for Donald Trump, for example, by getting information they then gave to WikiLeaks, which was made public to embarrass the Clinton campaign at various key stages of the campaign year? And what these people want to find out, first of all, is what is the extent of Russian involvement? What is the extent of the Russian engagement with the computer systems of our political system at all kinds of levels? Now, the Republican National Committee has said that they don't believe that they have been hacked. Others have said they have been, but the Republican National Committee's official statement is that they don't believe they've been hacked. And Donald Trump tweeted this morning that he didn't think anybody really knew who had done this hacking because you, quote, had to catch hackers in the act, unquote. That's got a lot of people in the technical community baffled and slapping their foreheads, wondering if that's what he really thinks.
Well, let's stay with Russia because we have to. It threads through so many stories today. There is reporting that Donald Trump is leaning towards Rex Tillerson, CEO of ExxonMobil, as his pick for Secretary of State. Trump hasn't made it official. NPR has not confirmed. But Tillerson has a long relationship with Vladimir Putin, one of being honor from Putin. NPR asked John McCain about that this morning.
I have concerns about what kind of business we do with a butcher, a murderer, and a thug, which is exactly what Vladimir Putin is.
Now, Senate Democrats would need just a few Republican defections to block Tillerson. How likely is that, Ron?
They could get three votes if people believe that Rex Tillerson really is big buds with Vladimir Putin and that he would represent, in some sense, the interests of Exxon or the interests of Donald Trump or some other business interest more than he would be representing, say, human rights or the defense of Eastern Europe or the defense of the Baltic republics in the job of Secretary of State.
Yeah. NPR Senior Washington Editor Correspondent Ron Elving. Ron, thank you.
Thank you, Robin.
And a note, you can hear more from Steve Inskeep's interview with John McCain on All Things Considered this afternoon and tomorrow morning on Morning Edition.
Well, for years, public health experts have worried that oil and gas development could be making people living near drilling sites sick. And health questions have only intensified as scientists compile more data. Reed Frazier of Here and Now contributor The Allegheny Front reports that some doctors in Pennsylvania want to put a pause on fracking to study its impacts on health.
Jane Worthington's daughter, Alexis, was basically healthy until 2011. That's when a gas company drilled a well a half mile from her elementary school in a Pittsburgh suburb. Worthington says that's when the symptoms came.
She's had unexplained bruising, excessive thirst, rashes, bullseye rashes, pink irritated eyes, bloody noses, swollen joints, and damage to her growth plates.
Worthington spoke at a press conference calling for stronger fracking regulations. And it's complaints like these that worry Philadelphia doctor Walter Tsu. So in 2013, he wrote a resolution for the Pennsylvania Medical Society, which represents around a quarter of the state's doctors, calling for a moratorium on new hydraulic fracturing. It didn't go over very well.
People said, you know, they built a new wing to my hospital now, and I really can't say anything bad about gas drilling, and it's too early for us to say anything because it's just started in our communities.
The Medical Society voted down his resolution, but this fall, the group reversed course, calling for a moratorium on fracking, making it the Society's official position. Pennsylvania Governor Tom Wolf, a Democrat, opposes a moratorium, as does the oil and gas industry. The industry warns a moratorium would harm the state's economy and points out that increasing natural gas use leads to less air pollution from coal. Fracking and related activities can contribute to ambient air pollution and potentially contaminate groundwater. And for years, people near well pads have complained about health impacts. Tsu, a former health commissioner of Philadelphia, says the best thing for the state would be to put a pause on new drilling.
We have to really rethink carefully about whether this is the right thing to do.
The Medical Society is also calling on the state to fund a registry on shale-related health complaints, as well as more research. Improving public health surveillance on this issue is crucial, says Ralph Schmelz, a Pittsburgh physician and past president of the Pennsylvania Medical Society. At a recent conference on fracking and public health, Schmelz said when the drilling boom first came to the state in 2008, there just wasn't that much research on how it could impact health. But that's changed.
In the last, 7 or 8 years, there's been an explosion of research in the area.
Recent federally funded studies show increased hospitalization rates, asthma, and premature births among people who live near fracking sites. But Schmelz has a word of caution about those studies.
But we still have tremendous difficulty because those symptoms are very common symptoms. Asthma is very common. Exacerbations of asthma are common. You know, headaches are common. Migraine headaches are common.
Basically, just because there's a link between fracking and health symptoms, that doesn't mean fracking is the cause. He says more studies are needed to help iron out this question. That's where a health registry would help. This year, the state gave $100,000 to the Department of Health to create a program to record the potential health impacts of drilling. So we're open for business to hear of any concerns or complaints.
Rachel Levine is Physician General of Pennsylvania. She says in the last 2 years, the Department of Health has received over 100 complaints from Pennsylvanians who said fracking nearby was making them sick. That includes reports of rashes, nosebleeds, and anxiety. Levine says while the registry is picking up more shale-related health complaints, right now it's not enough to put a pause on the fracking industry, like the Pennsylvania Medical Society wants.
I guess if there were consistent studies with compelling data that showed a clear and present danger, then we would certainly bring that to the administration's attention and consider that.
Meanwhile, the Medical Society's call for a moratorium will stay on the books. And Dr. Walter Tsu says he hopes the state government will take notice. For Here and Now, I'm Reed Frazier.
Much of Georgia is suffering from extreme drought, and forecasters say that's likely to continue in the next year. And that's putting pressure on states in the Southeast to conserve. In fact, Florida is suing Georgia in the Supreme Court. The case is part of a decades-long fight between the two states and Alabama. It could cap Georgia's water use in the Flint River Basin and hurt the state's economy. So some farmers in southwest Georgia are turning to a new tool to use less water. Big data. From Here and Now contributor Georgia Public Broadcasting, Sam Whitehead reports.
Meet Casey Cox. She's 25 and next in line to run her family's farm just outside the small city of Camilla, Georgia.
I'm the chief technology officer of the farm.
Is that your official title?
That is my unofficial title.
She'll be the sixth generation to grow peanuts, soybeans, and sweet corn along the Flint River. But Cox knows she'll only be able to contribute to Georgia's multi-billion dollar ag industry if she has water.
We wouldn't be able to produce anything without irrigation, especially in dry years. We all know that we wouldn't be able to do what we do without water, and we want to make sure we're using it responsibly for the next generation.
The Cox farm relies on 9 long metal sprinklers to water their crops. Their irrigators are already efficient, thanks to a technology that knows which parts of their fields don't need water.
We are able to remove those areas from irrigation, and so we have a 15% reduction in water use every time we turn the system on.
And that saves the Cox farm money. Casey Cox grabs her smartphone and opens up an app that's linked to a soil moisture monitor.
And we can pull up this app and look at the soil moisture level in the field, decide whether we need to irrigate or not, and then I can go to the next part of the app and cut the system on or off.
It is feedback control. You're making a change, and then you're seeing if that change had the effect, and it's just a closed loop. You keep monitoring and making a change.
Calvin Perry runs the University of Georgia's Stripling Irrigation Research Park. There, among the whisper of sprinklers, engineers are working to make irrigation systems smarter.
We know there's going to be periods for our farmers to remain productive that we're going to have to irrigate. So we want to help them be as efficient as they can be when they irrigate.
Leading that charge is UGA's George Valitis. I found him cleaning sandy soil from an auger, about to install a prototype soil moisture monitor with a colleague from Japan.
As you can see out here in these plots, we have a lot of different sensors installed. And the primary reason for these sensors is to watch what's happening in the soil moisture so we can verify our app models.
Those models will eventually drive apps that give farmers watering recommendations in real time. The idea is to take the guesswork and waste out of irrigation.
We convert this information, which is raw data on soil moisture, into actionable irrigation amounts.
One test showed Valitis' system could cut a farmer's water use in half. Applied to every irrigation system in the Flint River Basin, the impacts could be huge. But Gil Rogers, with the Southern Environmental Law Center, worries efficiency gains won't be enough.
Farm permits for water withdrawal are very permissive in Georgia. It's basically a rubber stamp.
He says Georgia's water laws were written that way to encourage the growth of the state's farm industry.
I think the problem now is that it's become too much of a good thing, and you've got more permits issued than there is water in a lot of cases.
Rogers wants Georgia to pass more sustainable water laws and says that could happen soon. A case before the U.S. Supreme Court could cap Georgia's use of water in the Flint River. That would be a great motivator for lawmakers to finally deal with the state's water allocation problems. But farmer Casey Cox isn't waiting for that. Back on her farm, she takes me through a stand of longleaf pines to the clear, quick-flowing Flint River.
We depend on this for everything. So we have absolutely every incentive to take care of it.
For Cox, being smart with water now isn't about usage caps or even saving money. She says conservation is an insurance policy for her future. For Here and Now, I'm Sam Whitehead.
Well, here's a headline that's been popping up in the news for nearly 100 years. Cursive writing is dying. The Common Core standards don't specify instruction in cursive, although some states, including Alabama, Tennessee, Louisiana, and California, have mandated cursive instruction in public schools. But with typing replacing writing more and more in everyday life, will cursive fade away? And if it does that matter? Joining us now is Steve Graham, professor at Arizona State University's Teachers College. Steve, welcome.
Glad to be here.
Now, I did see going back to 1935 that Time magazine reported back then that cursive was going away, and it's still here. Do you think that there's a chance that all these concerns are overblown?
I've been asked about the death of either handwriting or cursive handwriting for almost 20 years now. And one of my responses is, can you show me where it's buried? I didn't read the obituary. So I don't think either of these kinds of handwriting are going to go away right away. You know, honestly, handwritings and paper and pencil, you can carry with you anywhere. But let's be frank. You know, when we take a look at the writing that people do, both in school, outside of school, at work, and for play, much of it today is digitally. So you need to be able to type fluently as well.
And is cursive going away?
It is going away. It's used less and less today, just as handwriting in general is used less and less. The place where it's most likely to occur now is in schools, because we're using 19th century tools for writing instead of 21st century tools.
You sound like you're opposed to anybody teaching cursive at all then.
No, I'm not opposed to teaching cursive. I think we need to teach one style of handwriting really well so that it's legible and it can be produced fluently. That could be cursive, but it could also be manuscript or italics. Doesn't make a lot of sense, in my opinion, to teach two different forms of handwriting that basically serve the same goal.
And that goal is what?
Well, that goal is to be able to produce text that can be read easily by your audience, and it's also to be able to produce text that can be, or handwriting that can be done quickly and automatically so it doesn't interfere with other writing processes.
Are there clear benefits to learning cursive, to these states, for example, Alabama, Tennessee, Louisiana, California, that still want to teach cursive handwriting?
There's no clear advantage to teaching cursive over teaching, say, manuscript or italics. In all of those cases, they can be produced about equally well legibly and at the same speed.
Does the way we write, whether it's cursive or typing on a keyboard, influence how well we write?
It doesn't influence how well we write. And in fact, when you're working on a keyboard, there are a number of advantages, and one of those is that if you're using word processing, you can move text around very easily. Often you have other programs like spell checker or grammar checker that are built in there that provide you with some help as a writer. And there's actually considerable evidence to show that if we have kids write by hand or write on word processing, over about a six-month period, kids get better as writers when they're working with word processing.
Why did we start writing cursive in the first place and not just stick with manuscript?
Well, so there's always been this kind of formal and informal style of writing that has existed. And when I say always, obviously, I'm talking about the last couple of hundred of years. And so we thought it was important to teach both, one that you use in your everyday writing and one that we use for more important documents, more formal documents. And cursive has taken on that role.
Which do you use?
I use a combination of both, but if you said, how do I write most often, it's digitally.
Hmm. Actually, when you say use a combination of both, do you mean that the way that you write when you write by hand is a mix of the two, or you use it one sometimes and one the other time?
It's a mix of manuscript and cursive, and probably about 70% of kids who learn to use both actually mix them together as well.
When you write using cursive, or manuscript for that matter, do you remember what you're writing better than when you type it?
There's no real evidence that you remember information better whether you type it or whether you write in cursive or manuscript. However, there is some evidence that when you write out notes from a lecture, that there may be some advantages to doing it by hand. versus doing it on a word processor, simply because when you're doing it by hand, it's easier to show the connections between ideas. And so that's an advantage at this point for handwriting.
Now, when you talk about typing, I wonder whether that's kind of out of date at this point because more people are using their mobile phones and writing on those, which is, you know, often the keyboard is the same as it would be on a computer, but sometimes it's not.
No, and in fact, we're seeing a shifting landscape in terms of how one can compose. And I think smartphones are a good example of this. If you look around, you see a lot of people talking to their smartphones. So we're going directly from speech to text, which bypasses both typing or using your thumbs or using your hands to produce text messages. And so we're going to see more and more of that.
Is that a concern for you?
It's not a concern for me, but it is important to realize that each one of these tools has its strengths and limitations. And so something like speech-to-text means you're more likely to speak extemporaneously or off the top of your head and forego planning. And, you know, speech isn't exactly the same as writing something down and being more planful and thoughtful in it. So it may mean that we need to plan more often when we use speech-to-text.
I will say that the one thing I will not miss about cursive is the Z. I could never do that cursive Z, the lowercase Z.
Well, and it's not just that letter. Some people have a lot of difficulty with the uppercase Q, and it's shown in different ways. And so, you know, we're going to see less and less of handwriting as time goes on, but I don't think its epitaph is written yet. I think it'll still be around for a good while.
That's Steve Graham, who's a professor at Arizona State University's Teachers College, talking with us about the potential death of cursive. Steve, thanks so much.
You're welcome.
And if you want to share your thoughts, write it in cursive, take a picture, and post it at our website, hereandnow.org. The Federal Reserve is expected to increase a benchmark interest rate this week. It would be the first increase since last December, and that was the first increase in nearly a decade. Here to look at what a rate hike would mean for consumers is Jill Schlesinger. She's business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. Hi, Jill.
Hello.
Well, let's first talk about mortgages and what a rate hike would mean for people who want to buy a house.
Well, you know, a rate hike directly is not going to affect mortgage rates. However, rates have gone up by anywhere between a half to three quarters of a percent. And that is because the 10-year Treasury has increased. Investors really believe that a more quickening economy, maybe because of infrastructure spending or tax cuts, will require a higher interest rate environment that's pushed up mortgage rates. So, you know, it's not terrible. They're still pretty low. I will say that if you have an adjustable rate mortgage, that could see some higher pricing in the coming months as the Fed keeps raising interest rates.
And I was checking on the numbers. It looks like the current average for a 30-year fixed is somewhere around 4.2% right now, which, as you say, is still historically low, but not as low as it has been. Is there anything people can do to lock in a lower rate? Because we saw, we just talked about last week, that in Seattle, there's a big rush to buy homes because people want to get in there before the rates go up further.
Well, I mean, look, you can do a rate lock. You can buy a longer term, but the pressure really does build then to find a house that you like. And I always get a little bit nervous putting that kind of pressure on people. I think what you said before, though, is really more important, that historically, this is still a very low rate. And for maybe the average home out there, we're seeing the rate rise. Maybe it equates to, let's say, anywhere between, say, $70 to $100, even if it's a more expensive home, maybe it's $100 or $200 extra a month. May seem like a lot, but I hope that's not the difference between being able to afford a new house and not.
What about the effect of a rate hike on savings? People who have been making 12 cents every 6 months in their savings account, will that change?
Well, I'm very excited to tell you it will go from 12 to 12 and a half cents.
Right,
it's really
right.
Going to be terrific. Well, all right, look, last year when the Fed raised rates, it was such a bummer because, frankly, big financial institutions, they passed very little of the increase on to customers. So I don't think savers are going to be, like, excited anytime soon. But, again, if rates continue to rise next year, we will see more in our interest, but not a lot more. You're going to have to wait a couple of more cycles for that to occur.
And what about credit card rates and student loan interest rates?
Well, let's start with the student loans. You know, federal loans, they are fixed. So no impact from a rate increase. But remember, a lot of private loans, they're variable. You want to double check to see what your rate is based on. Could it be a T-bill here in the U.S. or the prime rate, maybe LIBOR? Those rates could start to change. You got to factor that in. With credit cards, yes, they have variable rates. And of course, unlike savings, you know, what happens is as soon as you get a slight increase, it'll pass through in a couple of billing cycles to your credit card. What you may want to do is if you got a job, you feel secure, you may want to do those one of those balance transfers to lock in a 0% rate or a lower rate at this point.
That's Jill Schlesinger, business analyst with CBS News and host of Jill on Money. And now, one of the top five influencers on LinkedIn. Congrats, Jill.
Hey, thanks so much.
After years of covering the migrant and refugee crisis in Europe and the war-torn countries many of them are fleeing, a group of journalists and photographers decided something was missing. A guidebook. Why not? Every other traveler in Europe has one. So they put together a 269-page book titled Europa, an illustrated introduction to Europe for migrants and refugees. There are lots of photos of the refugee crisis provided mostly by members of the international cooperative Magnum Photo. It's written in four languages, English, French, Arabic, and Farsi. It's also part history primer, part resource list. One of the people behind the project is the Belgian-Dutch journalist Lisa de Bode, who lives in Brooklyn but joins us from Brussels, where she's been distributing these books. Hi, Lisa.
Hi.
Well, and you haven't sent us a hard copy of this. I think this is fascinating. We've looked at a link online because you want these books to go to the refugees and the migrants.
Correct. Yeah. Yes. So we don't want to lose a single issue basically to press.
Yeah.
So we're sending all of them out to organizations. And
but we have looked through, and it's pretty fascinating. Here's just some of the table of contents. Death at sea, roots, the stories of different refugees, legal entry, Greece, Spain. It goes through the different countries. What is it that you wanted to impart?
So the idea is from Magnum photographer Thomas Dworzak, who'd been covering this crisis for years. And then the content of the book was developed by my editor, Alia Malik, who's a great writer, and she's been covering this crisis as well. And so as they were working on the front lines of this crisis, they were struck by the number of questions people had, both like practical concerns, like where to request asylum, what country should I best go to if I want the best healthcare system, but also people carried shame, shame about the pasts and countries that we were forced to leave behind. But then few people realized that only 71 years ago, Europe itself had been torn apart by the violence that they were just forced to flee. So that was one observation.
In other words, you wanted incoming refugees to know that Europe had a history of refugees, people fleeing from the very countries that these refugees are trying to get to right now.
Correct, yes. Mm. And so we really, that's something we really wanted to impart, Europe's own immigration history, which is very rich and, you know, which in 1951 gave rise to the Refugee Convention, which still today influences the laws that are being made to protect refugees. Yeah. But at the same time, we saw that at least part of the population, or at least politicians, seemed to have forgotten about this history, or at least they wanted to enforce like a collective amnesia of our own immigration history. So like taking those two observations, that's how we came up with the book, to remind people of their own histories as well.
Yeah. Well, it's part, as we said, guide, things like victims' rights and the right to due process and the freedom of expression in the media, how that works in Europe.
Yep.
It's also a cautionary tale, you know, death at sea of people who don't make it. I mean, what would you say to people listening right now who want to hear more about that, who worry that your guidebook might actually inspire more people to try to make this treacherous trip than maybe should?
Well, I think first and foremost, the guidebook is geared towards refugees or immigrants, people who need information when they will decide to go to a different country, because inevitably that's like a consequence of war. So
you're saying that
traveling
you're saying many refugees are going to come no matter, you know, whether there's a book or not, because they're fleeing something.
Exactly. Exactly. And so that's the reality of the world we're living in. And then whenever going to a new place, especially traveling in dangerous conditions, having information is key to making good decisions. And of course, like people have like their own networks and like will share information among themselves, among family members. And we hope that
adding to the collection of information out there might be useful.
Yeah. How did you decide what information? I'm looking at Spain. So the first item is same-sex marriage. Spain was the third country in the world to legalize same-sex marriage. Then pharmacies. Pharmacies are generally open from 9:30 a.m. to 9:30 p.m. You know, it just seems like a kind of a hodgepodge, but in an informative one. But how did you decide? I mean, same-sex marriage, would that be to telegraph to refugees coming in, this is legal here, although it may not have been in your home country, and this is accepted here, even though you may frown on it?
I think what happened when we looked at how to convey the information that's in the book, we started with the EU, the European Union, its history, where it came from, what inspired it. And that's when we looked at its charter, the Charter of Fundamental Rights of People of Residence in the EU. And the charter defines like what the laws should be in each member state. There's areas of the law that can differ, obviously, like every member state can still has their own areas of jurisdiction. But there's a lot of guidelines in there. So we took those principles and applied them to the different countries. And yes, so we talk about, as you mentioned, like freedom of sexuality, of religion, of those rights that are in the charter and every country should abide by. But then we also looked at, are these rights applied to everyone and is everyone being held to the same standard? And that's not the case. Usually immigrants and newcomers will not be able to enjoy the same rights.
Well, it's also maybe to give a heads up of some of the bewildering things that are common in individual countries. There's a gesture in France to signal that someone is drunk and another gesture in Austria to wish you good luck so that people will know what people are waving their hands at and what that means.
Yes, there are. You're right. There are random facts in the book as well. At the same time, we didn't want to just impart historic information or things that weren't very practical sometimes. So yes, information about some gesture people will make in a specific country is something that's part of the book as well.
Well, we also note in the table of contents at least a couple of the stories from people who've made the passage, migrants who've made the passage, are as told to Lisa Dubode. One is Halo Salam, a lawyer and sociologist, and another, he's 44, another is Mir Hatem Saa, who's 17. Can you give us very briefly, what would you want us to know about each of those refugees that you met?
So Halo, he's a guy I met in Berlin. So for the book, we went to look for people who used to be refugees and are now citizens of the country that they resettled in, and then decided to talk to us to impart some wisdom or a lesson that they had learned and wished that they had known before they migrated or fled. Halo's story, he used to be a refugee, and then he enrolled in university, got a job, saw he was really good at languages, so he interpreted and translated for his colleagues, other refugees like him. This, in the end, decided or compelled him to pursue a career as a social worker. So in the end, he got a job at a refugee shelter in Berlin, where he is now helping others arrive. And he said, I was so happy to see a large part of the German population welcome a lot of us compared to 10 years ago. This was a difference. I wasn't welcomed the same way. At the same time, I worry. I also worry a lot because it's not looking as if this will last.
Well, let me ask you about that, Lisa. It's really not. The same kind of anti-immigrant, there is too much migration sentiment that has propelled elections from the U.S. to the Brexit. Yeah. It may even affect Germany. It's already affected France. Mm-hmm. What are your concerns?
I think they're very similar to a lot of people listening right now. Immigration is a major point in the agenda of a lot of politicians now campaigning on nationalist dangerous agendas. And I wish I knew how to counter that. I think what we can do or what we aimed with the book is to show how similar a lot of our experiences are. Like if you'll read the oral histories in the book, the experience of migration and of conflict is one that a lot of Europeans and newcomers have in common. And I think it's important to remember that.
Well, maybe you can get a fundraising going. I mean, you obviously, yes, your dollars need to be carefully spent, but maybe the book can go wider so people can read these stories.
Definitely. So there are 5,000 physical hard copies out there, which isn't nearly enough. But the book can also be downloaded for free in both PDF version and ebook online. on our Facebook page. So that's where everyone can access it.
That's Lisa DeBode, a Belgian-Dutch journalist based in Brooklyn. The new book she co-authored is Europa, an Illustrated Introduction to Europe for Migrants and Refugees. You can find a link to it at hereandnow.org. Lisa, thank you.
Thank you.
And as for those gestures we were talking about, the one in France to signal that someone is drunk, where you make a ring with your thumb and forefinger and then you place that ring over your nose. In Austria, that gesture to wish someone good luck, make two fists, tuck your thumbs down in your fist and then pretend to pound on a table. You shake your fists up and down. In Germany, pointing an index finger to the head means someone's crazy. That seems kind of universal. In Greece, nodding your head backwards or raising your eyebrows means no. Tilting your head to the side means yes.
Ever since the election, Democrats have been asking whether Hillary Clinton did enough to reach out to white working class voters. The New York Times reported last week on a meeting of Democrats from the middle of the country who are trying to double down on economic issues and the middle class. And Vermont Senator Bernie Sanders expressed frustration about the party's outreach on CBS This Morning last month.
I come from the white working class, and I am deeply humiliated that the Democratic Party cannot talk to the people from where I came from. The Democratic Party has got to stand with the working people of this country.
But our next guest says that Clinton did not actually ignore the working class. She lost for other reasons. Derek Thompson is senior editor at The Atlantic. He joins us from New York. Hi, Derek.
Hi, Jeremy.
So you write that it is a dangerous myth that Clinton ignored the working class. Explain.
I do think that there is this fairly prominent post-election narrative that you heard right there from Bernie Sanders, which is that she lost because she ignored this group of people, the working class. And there are at least two levels where I object to the narrative. First, the working class is sometimes conflated with the white working class, but lower-income Americans are disproportionately black and Hispanic, two groups that Hillary won by wide margins. So when Clinton is talking about immigration and Black Lives Matter and other issues that some people consider to be, quote, identity politics, end quote, I do think that she's talking about the lives and the economic welfare of the working class. Second, I am surprised by the idea that she didn't talk about jobs for lower income Americans, because I had watched so many speeches where she did talk about jobs for working and middle class Americans, did so really in great, sometimes nerdish detail, which is why I do agree with the argument that maybe the message wasn't as finely honed and simple as Make America Great Again. But this idea that she ignored this group entirely, I think, is a little bit off base.
And what about the comments that got her into trouble when it comes to the white working class? Specifically, she was criticized for saying in March that she would put coal miners out of business. She apologized and said she was taken out of context. Let's listen to a little bit of what she said, and this includes the comments afterwards that are usually left out of this clip.
I'm the only candidate which has a policy about how to bring economic opportunity using clean, renewable energy as the key into coal country, because we're going to put a lot of coal miners and coal companies out of business. Right, Tim? And we're going to make it clear that we don't want to forget those people. Those people labored in those mines for generations, losing their health, often losing their lives to turn on our lights and power our factories. Now we've got to move.
So, as you know, the clip that we usually hear from that is, we're going to put a lot of coal miners out of business. And obviously that wasn't the full context of what she was saying. But she did get into trouble for that and also for the basket of deplorables comment. Did that specifically alienate white working class voters, or you don't believe that it did?
Well, to a certain extent, of course, the messages that the candidates put out are mediated by the media, right? So when Hillary Clinton says something like, we're going to put a lot of coal miners out of business, but then retrain them and put them back into business with clean, renewable energy jobs. Look, on the one hand, I do think that she's talking about work opportunities for the middle class, for the working class. But I can see how the soundbite and how the message itself could be construed to say we're essentially just going to destroy these companies. I would say, though, that, look, you know, we focus sometimes on coal mines and steel workers as if these are the only jobs left in America. I just looked this up. There are 83,000 coal miners in America. There are 64,000 steel workers. That's a lot of people, okay? But there are 160 million workers in this country. The fastest growing jobs are jobs like home health care aide and personal care aide and nurse assistant that you don't hear a lot on the campaign trail. You don't have a lot of sound bites about nursing assistants. But this is where the vast majority of Americans are working, are in this, in the kind of service sector jobs that this country is moving toward and that don't often get the same appreciation from candidates. And I do think that she spoke to these sort of jobs. She spoke about the jobs themselves and how to support them by helping, you know, working mothers and working fathers with the children that they're having. So again, I think the actual story here is a little bit more complex than the sound bites we're most familiar with.
So what is the reason that Clinton lost, in your view?
You know, I think that something very complicated is going on. I think we're living in a country with rising diversity, rising income inequality, and rising need for redistribution. And the combination of these forces, I think, makes for, as I said, for the Atlantic, a rather unstable and unpredictable system. Because here's what happens. Here's what we've seen in other countries. You have countries that are often majority white that'll pass redistribution policies, welfare states, in countries where white, where the rich white and the poor white look really similar, and so empathy is easier to come by. But then we also see that as the lower class becomes more diverse, as you get more Muslims, more blacks, more Hispanics in that country, you tend to have less support for redistribution policies. It's as if when all this money is going to poorer groups of people, the white rich only want to distribute this, the poor rich only want it distributed if people who look like them are benefiting. Mm. So I do think that this for many liberals and people who consider themselves to the left of liberals, leftists, what they want for America is something like pluralist social democracy, something like Northern European public policy combined with a celebration of diversity. But the scary thing is that these two things, there's really been no effective advocate for this very complex thing, a pluralist social democracy. And I think that is what got Hillary Clinton.
That's Derek Thompson, senior editor at The Atlantic. We'll link you to his piece at hereandnow.org. Derek, thanks.
Thank you.
And I'm Jeremy Hobson.
I'm Robin Young. This is Here and Now.
Funding for Here and Now comes from Landmark College, a college serving students who learn differently, with faculty specializing in LD support, associate, bachelor, and summer programs, plus transitional bridge semesters beginning late January. More at ldbridge.org.